You're listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
Good evening. Glad to all see you here. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programs at the Library Foundation of LA. The Library Foundation, in partnership with the Los Angeles Public Library, is helping to define the library of the 21st century, a place that is bigger than a building and more than books, a place that facilitates equal access to information and helps to nurture literacy and creativity. If you're interested in supporting the work of the library and becoming a member of the Library Foundation tonight, just visit us in the lobby after this show. Now, for tonight's event, I'm pleased to introduce Otessa Moshfegh and Amanda Stern. Otessa Moshfegh is the author of three novels and one volume of short stories. Her work has appeared in numerous magazines, including The New Yorker, Granta, and the Paris Review. She's garnered many awards from the get-go, including the O. Henry Prize and the Penn Hemingway Award for debut fiction. She'll be in conversation with Amanda Stern. Amanda Stern's work has appeared in many periodicals, including the New York Times, the New York Times Magazine, as well as The Believer. She's written a novel and most recently a memoir entitled Little Panic, Dispatches from an Anxious Life. Amanda is also the creator and founder of the popular music and literary series Happy Ending, which hosted more than 600 artists over a 10-year period, ending its run in 2016 in New York. In a New Yorker profile of Otessa Moshfegh, Ariel Levy described Moshfegh's characters as tending to be immoral, frank, bleakly funny, very smart, and perverse in their motivations in ways that destabilize the reader's assumptions about what is ugly, what is desirable, what is permissible, and what is real. This is what makes us want to turn the page and keep reading. We want to keep exploring the underbelly of life. While Moshfegh looks at the physical body, making even the descriptions of the body's excretions exquisite, Amanda looks at the origins of the underbelly and its emotional manifestations. That's why I thought this pair would be interesting. Let me introduce Otessa Moshfegh and Amanda Stern. Thank you.
Thank you. I almost fell.
Well, I'm glad you didn't.
I made it.
You did. Hi, everyone. You're very nice-looking people. Aren't they nice-looking?
I don't have my glasses on.
Oh, okay. They're nice-looking. So I'm really happy that I'm getting to do this with you.
Thank you for doing it.
You're welcome. I'm really a big fan of your work, and I think you know that because I wrote you years ago. I told you. I wrote her a fan letter on email. And I have read, I think you might be the only person, honestly, whose work I've read all of. I'm not done that with anyone else. So thank you.
Thank you.
Anytime. So I read somewhere that you have anxiety. Is that true?
Do I seem anxious?
No. Do you?
Yeah. I think my anxiety is, it kind of takes two forms.
Mm-hmm.
One is like the anxiety of ecstasy, and the other is a excruciating vigilance of every moment of my life.
That sounds fun.
So, yeah.
What do you mean the anxiety of ecstasy?
What the hell does that mean? The like mania of joy,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Like, do you not trust joy?
No, I trust it.
Okay.
I trust it. But they're like, you know, on the subject of writing.
Yeah.
Like when I'm writing, like my heart will palpitate basically, and I will have to like stop and walk around and like calm myself down because I'm so into what I'm doing.
All right, so that's really interesting. So your heart will palpitate while you're writing because you're so into what you're doing. Is the palpitation because you're afraid you're going to lose something?
No, I'm just...
You're so into it.
So into it, yeah.
Huh.
It's just very exciting, and I think that is also kind of like anxiety, like a physical anxiety.
Could be, yeah. I've never had that form of anxiety. I want that.
It's like when you're on a roller coaster, you know?
Yeah, don't do that either.
I wouldn't, but you don't.
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, you wrote a whole book about anxiety.
Yes, I did, but we are not here for that.
Okay.
One thing I was wondering about, I am opening up with anxiety, though, because it is my only topic. But how does anxiety not deter you from putting work out into the public? How do you manage to not let it, get in your way of putting work out for the public?
I just don't have anxiety about that.
That's incredible.
I have anxiety about other things. I have anxiety about, like, where I put the bread, you know, in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
But it's stupid.
No, that's not stupid. I just don't think that's anxiety.
No, it is definitely anxiety.
Really? Where'd you put the bread?
Yes. I mean, anxiety is a feeling, right? It's not thoughts. So you can project... Okay, you're the expert. I'm just going to tell you what I think.
Tell me your anxiety.
Like, my anxiety feels like a vague existential dread.
Uh-huh.
And I can ascribe it to mundane things.
Got it.
Or I can think about what is the universe? How am I really here?
Uh-huh.
And go get really anxious and depressed in that direction. Or I can be like, okay, I'm driving my car. I'm going to take my hand and move it like this to move the wheels of the car.
Yeah.
And hopefully I won't kill anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's that anxiety.
Right. Yeah, I get you.
Okay.
And you're able to funnel that into your work.
Yeah, I mean, there's anxiety. Yeah, I mean, we're kind of trying to... push the conversation into it. Like, I don't have that much anxiety.
Okay, good.
So,
all right, so we're going to move on.
Okay.
So let's talk about panic. No, I'm kidding. People have made a big deal about how dark and gross your characters are. And do you believe that you're telling people a truth that they don't want to hear?
It's, I could say that. I mean, I could hypothesize that that's what people are experiencing when they have a response that's like, oh my God. But that in a way, you know, right. I think that like experiencing art, especially narrative art or visual art, it's the most satisfying, interesting, and I think productive when it's not only an intellectual exercise, but there's some kind of visceral experience that plays into the our relationship with the art.
Right.
And I've never enjoyed literature that's just been completely divorced from the body.
Right.
I mean, I just can't relate to it. So. I didn't set out to write stuff that's going to be dark and disgusting.
Right.
But disgust is something I'm attracted to. Like we were talking backstage about what we like to watch on Netflix, and I was like, "Well, I like true crime drama, mostly murders."
Yeah.
You know, that's just where my curiosity is, and I mean, it's not because I'm a murderer, but I would never murder anyone.
Sure.
Yes, positive. But so for my work, I think that I tend to employ dark and disgusting things so that I'm in relationship to my reader in a way that isn't just words on the page.
Right. See, it's interesting because when I read your work, That's not how I respond to it. I don't respond to it as though it's dark and disgusting, mm-hmm. or it's like the underbelly. I just feel like you're writing about people I want. Maybe something's up with me, but I want to spend time with them. You know, I do. I don't mind the. I do disgusting things, like truly, really disgusting things, and so do all of you. And I like to read about it. I don't know. I think there's something really true about it. So it's interesting to me, the response, you know, that people are sort of not up in arms, but they're making a big deal out of it in some way. And to me, that's very strange.
Well, I think it's something to talk about. And
it's
kind of easier to talk about the topics of someone's work rather than the craft or how it fits into culture. I mean, it's really easy to talk about, oh, this female character is really disgusting. It's like, okay, it's popular.
Yeah.
Like, it's popular to talk about that, but it's not really the focus of my work.
It's not relevant, yeah. It is true, though, that if you read reviews, they no one talks about writing. No one talks about the sentence. No one talks about the craft of writing. At least not any reviews that I've seen. Have you? Have you seen that?
I don't know. I don't read reviews.
Yeah, you're smarter than I am.
Because reviews are for the people who are going to go and buy the books.
Right.
Like, I don't know if the literary criticism ever in America had, like, a really...
Yeah.
I don't know. I was born in 1981. I don't know.
I was born in 2000.
So you don't know either.
No, I don't know anything.
So, I mean, reviews were never very important.
Right.
They're part of marketing.
Yeah.
They're not truth or a reflection of, I don't know.
Well, they're the reviewer's subjective truth, which leads me to the, I'm sorry, I keep hitting the mic. I have a man hand or something. Does it upset you when people misinterpret or misunderstand your books? Or do you just, are you fine with open interpretation?
I think it would start to upset me if people stopped reading my books.
Yes.
But these days I Google myself less, but I'm rarely upset by things I see people saying on Twitter. Maybe like 1 out of 100 times if somebody said something about me on Twitter, I'll really take it to heart. But today I looked myself up on Twitter.
Okay.
And, oh no, I'm sorry, it was Instagram. And I don't have these accounts.
Right.
So I'm confessing that I'm
who
like
are you,
putting
who are you
my
going
name
through?
Into
Is this
the
some sort of a
engine.
Scam?
Huh?
Who are you going through? Are you going to get on?
You just Google your name.
No, no. This I know.
Oh, okay.
I'm doing it right now. you're going through whose account?
No account. You don't need an account.
Oh, okay. You're right. I know. Okay. Go on. Sorry.
Anyway. Somebody had posted a photo of a page from McGlue, the book that I wrote over 10 years ago that just got reissued. And I guess they had bought this reissued copy and had circled a word and written on the top, fuck you, moshfag. And in the comment, he said, I have literally spent hundreds of dollars on books by Otessa Moshfegh, given them as gifts to friends, and like as soon as I saw this, like I'm just done. Like I'm done with her. And how did this get published? And it's because the word was fag, and fag is so McGlue is about. A murder, and it's told in a by the protagonist. It's a first-person narrative of this character, McGlue, telling the story of how he murdered this other man in a drunken blackout, having had brain damage from jumping off a train and hitting his head like months earlier. And he's in love with the guy.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy, and so in the course of the book, the narrator refers to a homosexual character as fag mm-hmm. in an obviously hostile
It also takes place
way.
In 1851.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, when I saw, I was like, God, did he know that the protagonist is homosexual?
Right.
You know, it's like this isn't hate.
Right.
It's a character expressing some sort of subconscious something subconscious
yeah.
through language that you're supposed to see.
Right.
But he isn't aware of it. So,
right.
you know, I saw that and I was like, well, that's kind of interesting. And it made me kind of want to tell him, like, well, if you finish the book,
right,
like, you'll see that he was actually deeply in love with the man he murdered. So this isn't a book about how we should hate gay people.
Right. I was wondering what the response was going to be as I was reading the book. Because of the word, and I haven't seen anything, so that's interesting.
Yeah, I hadn't run into anything either.
Yeah, that's just laziness, though.
I mean, you know, people are sensitive. I
yeah,
understand.
Yeah, they are. Actually, I have a question about that.
Okay.
Let me see if I can find it. Yes, it's highlighted. What do you say to critics who believe you shouldn't write from a point of view you haven't experienced, particularly with respect to race and gender and ethnicity?
You know, I've been having this conversation in my head
mm-hmm.
because the book that I'm currently working on
mm-hmm.
is about a Chinese teenager,
mm-hmm.
a girl,
mm-hmm.
a Chinese teenage girl who immigrates from Shanghai to San Francisco. Assuming the identity of her brother. So she's in drag,
mm-hmm.
essentially. And it takes place at the turn of the century, like 1904. And I didn't question it at all.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a story I feel called to write.
Right.
So I'm not gonna change it into somebody that approximates my identity, because that doesn't make any sense. So a couple of things that I could say to those critics.
Yeah.
The first would be, I haven't heard a lot of people get angry about the way that Asians are portrayed in literature.
Mm-hmm.
And this book is very much concerned with the total disregard and forgetting that our country had utterly racist immigration policies
mm-hmm.
and that women were actually not allowed to immigrate from China, and the ones that were smuggled in were sex workers, and that is still happening. So
mm-hmm.
I'm like, if people get angry that I'm appropriating a Chinese
right.
character and they have this conversation, I will be thrilled.
Yeah.
Because it's not a conversation that people seem to be having.
Right.
The other thing is, you know, and this is maybe like a privileged position that I occupy because, and you can think what you want about it, but I don't really know how to identify myself ethnically
mm-hmm.
because my father is from Iran, my mother is from Croatia, so I'm half Eastern European, half Middle Eastern. I did not grow up with any religion. My parents are weirdos. And, you know, I am me.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been to Iran. I don't speak either of those languages.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I grew up in a predominantly white culture, suburb of Boston. You know, like a lot of prestige and education and, you know, that sphere, but I never felt white.
Mm-hmm.
obviously I'm not black or something else, but right. I don't feel Middle Eastern, you know? Mm-hmm. So I've written 4 books.
Mm-hmm.
Most, I'd say like 99% of my characters are white.
Right.
So what are you going to go, if you're going to come at me, are you going to go back and look at everything else and right. tell me I was appropriate, like Eileen, like I was appropriating then? Really?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just, I hope I don't have to have that conversation, but.
Yeah.
I don't ever have to, I guess.
Right.
But,
yeah. But you can also point all these things out, which are legitimate. So I want to talk about your actual writing for a minute. Well, I actually really want to talk about it for a very long time, but we have a limited period of time here. There's an ecstasy in your prose. Like, there's just this propulsive energy to your sentences. There's just beautiful velocity to every sentence, even, you know, the simplest ones. And when I'm reading your work, I have... With every book that I've read of yours, I've had the same question. And it might sound really strange, but I really want to know, is there a part of your body that you're writing from? Is it your head? Is it your, like, where do you write from?
It's like in this area.
Mm-hmm. Like, it, really? In the
yeah.
throat area?
Not the throat, but it's actually, like, in front of my body.
Uh-huh.
I would say it's, like, right here.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
But I'll tell you this, like when I have an instinct,
yeah,
it's from right here.
Huh.
It's like in my blind spot on the left,
right.
I'm right-handed. So it's like something travels this way and then.
And if you feel like something's not working or something's wrong, where do you feel that?
That is inconsistent. I mean, actually, that's up here.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
I'd say that's up there.
Interesting.
Or in the eyes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you're working on a story or on a novel, are you just following your fingers? Are you lost in it? And then, or are you intellectualizing while you're writing? Like, what's your process in terms of intellectualizing and intuiting your sentences and the way that you build a story or a longer piece?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it's different, but let's take a longer piece or a novel.
Okay.
Since you're no longer really writing short stories for now. For now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't want that to be a forever thing. But how do you, what is that like for you? How do you build that? How do you build that that space?
You know, I use my imagination, and
mm-hmm.
I don't, is that, like, you know, what's your imagination? Is it intellectual? Sort of.
Right.
But it's like, what?
I said right.
Oh, yeah. But it's also instinctual.
Yeah.
So it's kind of just like the way that you dream.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an efforted thing.
Right.
It's, I'm okay. asking, sometimes I'll ask a question, but it's usually like, oh, what is it? I'm like, oh, I know. It's like this. Or wait, what, it's kind of like this. And I'll get, you know, sometimes it's a very specific answer, and sometimes it's vague, like really kind of an abstract sense of what the thing is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just get closer to it. So in
right.
the actual writing, it can be like, it's kind of like this.
Right.
And then I was like, okay, no, it's actually more like this and moving things. I'm like, okay, that sounds right. And what does that sentence mean? Okay, so I've gone from here to here. I do it a lot, obviously, like tracking
right.
like the reader's consciousness through like this sentence and then the next sentence. So at the end of this sentence, they're going to be feeling blah and thinking about this. So if I start the next sentence with this word, you know, what's the effect of that? You know, like, do I want to continue this sentiment and then twist it here or wherever, you know?
Right.
It's just playing around. It is really instinctual, but in order to write, you have your... It's not like I'm finger painting, you know? Like,
right.
We have to use language, which is coming from a more logical place in the mind.
Right. But some people say that they just channel these voices or, you know, like, that doesn't happen for me. But some people talk about writing that way. But do you have a question? So do you have a question as you're writing, or is there a central question that you ask before you start? Like, is there a question that your books try and answer?
I mean, the only thing that I try to answer is what is the book?
Uh-huh.
What's the story?
Right. And you just keep asking that?
Yeah.
The whole way. Yeah. Do you start your books thinking that they're about one thing, and then by the end you're like, no, it's about this?
Huh? What did you say?
Do you start your books thinking that they're about one thing?
Uh-huh.
And then you get to the end and you're like, nope, it's actually about this.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little?
I definitely know what you're talking about.
Okay.
I think it's like the difference between intention and manifestation.
Mm-hmm.
That there's always I'm always surprised at what things turn out to be.
Right.
But that surprise is also like, I know that when I start a project, I'm like, I really want to learn whatever this is going to teach me.
Mm-hmm.
So if it ends up being not what I thought, that means that I have changed. So I'm like, good. Then this was worth doing.
Right.
Or like, I grew from this.
Right. Have you changed? Or maybe that really wasn't the thing you needed to learn.
Wait, what? Have I changed? Or maybe that wasn't the thing that I needed to learn?
So if you start writing something, you think it's about one thing, and you get to the end, and it turns out it's about another thing, you said that you've changed.
Mm-hmm.
But is it that you've changed, or that... Never mind.
I mean, I definitely have changed.
Okay. I believe you.
Because when you start, I mean, everyone changes over the course of a year or two.
Yeah.
And when you're writing a novel, you're like in a relationship and also like a hell zone, mm-hmm, with yourself.
Yeah.
That you have to grow or else you won't survive it. Like,
right.
You won't finish it. So if you get to the end, you've definitely learned and changed.
Right.
Or grown. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel like your work is part of the cultural conversation about women?
I think that it can have that function,
mm-hmm,
once it's published.
Yeah.
But I personally don't feel attached to that conversation in my work.
Yeah.
I'm not thinking in those terms.
Right. I think that's kind of good. I don't know why, I just do. What are the elements of writing that you think you're best at?
Define elements.
What are the aspects of writing that you think you're best at?
Synonyms. I'm just kidding.
So is she.
Shit, I don't know.
Okay.
I think maybe one aspect is I'm good at finishing things.
Uh-huh.
Like when I mean, there's like, you know, I was raised by a very passionate classical musician,
mm-hmm,
who instilled in me a great pressure to be self-disciplined,
uh-huh,
and productive.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that now, because if if I say to myself, I'm going to finish this by this date,
mm-hmm.
9 times out of 10, I've done it. And it will seem kind of like magic.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So I think that's one thing I'm good at.
Do you have an appreciation for your sentences?
Yes.
Okay, like, good.
Yes.
Good. They're magical.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Who are your kindred spirits in the world? Do you have any? Mm-hmm. Just flick away stuff on your skirt.
I don't know. I really love a lot of people, but I don't know if I would say I've found a kindred spirit.
Well, like, how about a kindred spirit as an artist? Who's like an artist? I know one person.
I just interpreted your question so naively. Who was your favorite person? My husband. The first person that pops into my head is Kurt Cobain. I guess like other musicians.
Right.
Bach.
Uh-huh.
So egotistical. And then maybe like some comedians.
Ooh, like who?
Jerry Lewis.
Interesting.
Jerry Lewis was a big influence on me when I was young. I watched a lot of Jerry Lewis movies.
Huh.
Woody Allen.
Uh-huh.
Some painters. I mean, Picasso.
Yeah. It's good. It's a good list.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. How have you evolved as a writer since McGlue?
How have I evolved as a writer? Well, I think that, like, you were talking about sentences, and I think that I've actually, in my writing for my process, have become a little bit less paranoiac about sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And the materiality of language.
Mm-hmm.
Like, McGlue is really very much about language.
Yes.
And I feel like my last novel that came out over the summer was not as interested in mm-hmm. language.
Right.
It's using language, but there's, I think that it's like there's a fluidity of the voice that is kind of taking the language for granted,
mm-hmm.
so that the reader isn't working to parse out and understand what's being written,
mm-hmm.
but is my attention is just that I hypnotize you,
right.
so that you read the entire book and have an experience where I like the book sort of takes over. I mean, you have your consciousness, of course, but for McGlue, I think that I was more interested in this really tactile
mm-hmm.
way of writing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Have you read Moby Dick?
No.
It's amazing. McGlue reads a lot like Moby Dick.
Call me Ishmael?
Yes. See, you
Such
have read it.
Such a great opening line. I know the opening line, I've never actually read the book.
I'm pretending like I've read it, but I've read like 20 pages. But that's pretty much reading it.
It only 20 pages long?
It's only 20 pages long.
I should read it.
It's essentially like the same 20 pages. That's what I imagine. But no, there's something about McGlue it's astounding how easily you seem to embody place and time and atmosphere and tone. You know, it's remarkable. I really don't know how you do that.
I got really lucky stumbling on this story.
Yes.
And it was kind of the thing my whole life had been preparing me for,
mm-hmm.
in terms of the landscape of my imagination and the grit that I was interested in.
Right.
Like literarily and emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a perfect marriage of like who I was at the time.
Right.
And my creative interests. And McGlue really felt like it was delivered to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I made up the entire book, but there were a couple of things that were sort of handed to me through an article that I had written. That I had read.
Yeah. Do you want to tell them the story about the article?
The article is it was a small announcement in a newspaper, I think published in Massachusetts in 1851 or 52, somewhere around there. And it was just McGlue. Mr. McGlue has been, what's the word?
I can't remember, but it was.
When you're not convicted.
Oh.
Acquitted.
Acquitted.
Acquitted on account of murder because he was in a drunken blackout and had hit his head having fallen off a train or something.
Yeah.
And the man that he murdered was named Johnson. And that was it.
Yeah.
That was the beginning. And he was from Salem. So.
Huh. And then you just imagined all the gaps. That's amazing. I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions, and then we're going to let you guys ask some questions. I might have really asked all these questions. One second. All right, I am going to ask this one. This is going to be the last one.
Okay.
Oh, now I have like two more. But in interviews, you talk very freely about your work and your intelligence, and people are alarmed by it because women aren't supposed to announce their accomplishments. But because you look so carefully at behavior in your work, I wonder if your pronouncements are or have been sort of a preemptive strike against something.
What do you mean?
I mean that, I don't know, I have, of all the interviews I've read of you where you've been quoted as in The Guardian or whatever the article interview is, that, you know, you'll say, I'm talented, I'm gifted, I'm smart, I'm da-da-da, and people are so taken aback by it.
Wait, I've got to stop you. That was a setup.
What do you mean?
The guy came over.
Oh, good. Get it out.
By the way, he left a ring from the tea that he put on the table, and it's still there. And he asked me, what do you think are your good qualities?
Oh, what a jackass.
So what am I supposed to be like? Oh, I don't know. I'd be a nice person.
Right.
Like, of course I'm like, well, I'm talented. I work hard.
Right.
Like, so whatever.
Right. So because my reading of that was... Oh, this is brilliant. She is trying to protect her writing time. Like, it almost felt like a preemptive strike, so that people would just leave you alone.
Oh, like, oh, this woman is really arrogant. Let's not mess with
her.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, that is so smart. But you were set up.
I mean, that was just a cheap...
Yeah, it's a cheap... Yeah.
Headline.
Yeah. It was. All right, so I was wrong then, but... I really...
Oh, no, I mean, certainly, like, I'm not going... I'm not, like, a withering...
No, I know, of course not. Like, but I was like, that is a genius move.
Well, I had not thought that far ahead.
All right, well...
Yeah.
Okay, so you're... this was lovely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I'm going to turn it over to these guys, and you can ask Otessa Moshfegh anything that you would like, and she might answer it or not.
Yes. Okay, the question is, what made you, when you grew up, not make you familiar with the culture of your parents.
In the language and the history, and did it influence your artistic production later on, your background or not?
Are you Persian?
I'm not, but I speak Persian.
Okay.
I'm Croatian.
Oh, you are?
And I speak Persian. So you and I have both in things in common, except I don't write.
Usually it's Persian people who ask me that question. That's why I asked you, and I'm not wearing glasses, so I don't know what you look like. Well, my parents met in music school in Belgium, and then they moved to Iran and had to leave and move to America. And I think that it's like their common language was English. And I was born the year after they moved to Massachusetts. And there wasn't culturally, there wasn't like a community that my parents were involved in. They were alone, and they didn't share the same heritage. So we were just weird together. And I made an effort. I mean, I regret that I didn't get to know my Iranian grandparents, but my Croatian grandparents lived in Croatia until they died, and I made an effort to learn the language when I was in college so that I could go and speak to them. And so I did that, and then very promptly forgot all of the Croatian that I had learned, I think because it was sad for me that it wasn't a bigger part of my life, or that there was this part of my history that was left behind. But it's also just painful that like my parents' history in these countries, like there's a reason they left, you know? So maybe I'm resistant to it. And, you know, my dad has been back to Iran once since the revolution, and I think it was devastating. So I'm not really drawn to it. I'm also totally obsessed with English, and it's hard enough to understand what the hell is happening here. You know what I mean? I think if anything, it made me it certainly changed the way that I looked at American, the Americanness around me, because I didn't take it for granted because my parents weren't American, if that makes sense.
Hi. So, speak up. Okay. So, my girlfriend Carol and I have been reading partners for about 30 years, like writing partners, but we read together. And we keep a list of books every year that we send out to all our friends. And our absolute favorite last year was My Year of Rest and Relaxation. And when my friends would say, okay, so what is it about? I would say, well, it's about this woman who takes a year to rest and relax. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to ask you, what was your intent in creating it? What was it about from your perspective?
I can only really speak in hindsight because I can't really remember what I was thinking when I wrote it. But I think that it's about recovery. And the title, Rest and Relaxation, is sort of tongue-in-cheek. Because although the character sleeps a lot, it's very stressful. Like, her life is very stressful. And she's sleeping to both, like, avoid her unhappiness, but she's also trying to erase herself, which is so violent, and not relaxing at all. I think what I was trying to figure out maybe was how something that violent and complicated could actually work. You know, like, she starts off out the protagonist with this idea that if she can sleep long enough, she will be, you know, her whatever she says, like her cells will have reproduced the number of times it would take for the cellular trauma to have left her system so that she could be reborn as a new person with a new attitude and a whole new set of feelings and perception. So, you know, that sounds insane. Although, you know, it isn't actually beyond the realm of possibility. There, so the doctors have used sleep as cures for a lot of things. But, like, there's a sleep, well, whatever. I didn't know that when I was writing it. But by the end of the book, I mean, you see her go into this, like, extremely profound chasm of lostness in the final throes of her sleep project, and she actually emerges convinced that it worked. So, I don't know, I'm just questioning if, like, maybe it would, you know? Like, who are we to say? Because who are we, like, is there actual an ideal self that we're supposed to be? And, like, our job in life is to, like, sand off the wrong rough edges until we're, like, the perfect person. Like, if she thinks that she's going to be right when she's done at the end of the year and that helps her, like, good on her. That's kind of how I looked at it.
My question is this on? My question is also about my year of rest and relaxation, specifically about the last page or the last chapter. I started reading the book to when it ended, I kind of through math realized exactly when it was going to end. And I really don't want to spoil it, so I'm trying not to give much more detail than that. But did you write the book with the intention of having that as your last chapter or the last page, or did it kind of evolve as you were writing the book?
It evolved early on in the generating of the actual text. I didn't know that I had set the book in the year leading up to 9/11 until I was actually writing, like, mostly scenes in New York, and the character has a job before she leaves to sleep for a year, has a job at an art gallery. So there's some, the book touches a lot on art in the New York art scene. And I kind of just recognized that the culture that I was describing was a pre 9/11 New York. So I was like, okay, this is where I am. It's the year 2000. And then the story developed from there.
Yeah. Thank you for being here. I love how well you seamlessly managed to write well. You speak really emotionally, like the characters have a lot of emotional integrity. And then you also tend to speak to a lot of political and social issues, even though it seems kind of underhanded. So my question is, to what extent is that intentional? And I'm thinking specifically of your rest and relaxation. I don't know if it's because I read it right after I read about the opioid crisis, but one of the things that I was really interested in was the ease with which she was able to get all of these sedatives and sleep aids. So I was curious, like, how intentional was the commentary there, or was it just kind of, did it just kind of happen?
It was definitely not commentary on the opioid epidemic. But, you know, I had strong feelings about psychiatry, but it's still personal, you know? I'm not trying to engage politically. I'm not trying to engage politically in an overt way. Yeah. Is that it? Oh.
Hi. I got really happy when you said Kurt Cobain was really important to you. And I was born the same year as you, and he was important to me. And I just wondered if you had any special memories or about listening to Nirvana or grunge that you and its influence on you, you would want to share.
Thanks for asking that question. Yes, and I have complicated feelings about the influence of Kurt Cobain on me personally and in my generation, but that's later. I'll talk. I don't know, like whatever. But the first time that I saw or heard Nirvana was when they played Saturday Night Live. I don't know what year it was, like 1993 or something. And I was 12, or maybe it was even earlier than that. And I remember watching it. They played Smells Like Teen Spirit and feeling like I could actually, like somebody had totally identified the violent emptiness that I felt. And I couldn't believe it. It totally blew me away. And I remember saying to my big sister, who was watching it with me, "This makes me feel like nothing matters." And like nothing was the same afterwards, because it was like I had been living in a world that everyone was pretending and no one was admitting the weirdness of the feeling of being alive and conscious. And like there on TV was this performance that totally confirmed that I wasn't the only one who felt that way. And I think that's why he touched so many people. But yeah, that was a very important experience.
Hello.
Hello.
I was really interested in how you were discussing, using your hands as well, the way in which you achieve hypnosis or captivation with your reader by kind of anticipating or tracking the subconscious and on a sentential level, the way that a sentence begins and ends. And I really felt that way reading my year of rest and relaxation. And a big part of that captivation, I think, was, of course, with the protagonist, but this very strong desire to know her name. And there was a loud absence of that as I was moving through the book. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about that decision.
Yeah, I wrestled with that a bit, because I thought that I believed that characters should all be named. Even though I think the reason I thought that was that somebody once told me that, and it disagreed with what I thought. So I was like, oh, that's really interesting. Maybe that is true. Maybe I do think that. But then when I was writing this book, it was just like any name that I was going to give her was going to be so tacky. Like there was no name that wasn't going to make her, to me, seem like somebody I'd want to dismiss. So she needed to be nameless, like bigger. More of an abstraction, you know? And also, I think that she feels distant. I mean, even though she's talking to you directly, telling you these things that she's thinking and doing, it's all very mediated, you know? And I think that's part of, like, the refinery of the sentence, like, paragraph and the movement of the prose, is that it is, like, very well-crafted, in a way that is a little bit removed, you know? Like, she isn't totally vulnerable, and she does have some walls up against the reader, and I think that, like, that anonymity was something that she was guarding that served the book to feel, like, a little bit distanced.
Hi. I was curious, I imagine this may be different from project to project, but for you, how much your work changes from a first draft to what may be eventually the published draft as a writer? I'm always curious about different writers' processes. Thank you.
It's different for each project. My Year of Rest and Relaxation was a book that I edited so much in writing, in generating the book, that my first draft was roughly the final draft. I mean, there were, you know, 7 or 8 edits, but it did not change in any great structural way because I had been changing it the whole time. Eileen, on the other hand, was a book that I drafted very quickly and wrote in present tense third person in the first draft. And the final draft ended up being first person past tense. So I was completely retranslated. And that the bulk of the work of that book was in revision.
Last question.
Yeah, this guy has been. No, we can have two.
Oh my God, really? Wait, go ahead.
No, we can have two.
This feels selfish. I don't usually think about book covers, but I think the cover of my Year of Rest and Relaxation is like iconic and just so perfect. I was wondering if it was in your head or if it was the publisher or if it was like a long process to get there or how did that work?
It wasn't long. I suggested that we put it an image that was a painting because the characters had studied art history. And in the novel, she talks about this one painting that had really disturbed her called The Death of Marat by Jacques or Jean-Louis David. I always forget. But it's about this French revolutionary who's bleeding to death in a bathtub. And it's so disturbing and cool. And there's no way I could put that on the cover of the book, but so I looked up other paintings by the same artist and found the portrait that was just, I don't know, it really nailed the sense of ennui and like sardonic something, like brattiness a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then my best friend Rosie suggested the hot pink and it all just kind of, my publishers conceded to the hot pink, so that's how it ended up being there. Okay.
Truly last question.
The voice you tell your stories with, or the voices, are so powerful that to me it, you know, your stories and novels almost kind of, reject kind of a tendency towards social commentary or historical and all that, but at the same time, thinking about where you, the set, I kind of piggybacking on the question about the setting and time and place of Year in Rest and Relaxation, and now hearing you describe your new project as well, thinking about like this kind of specter of coming disaster, that these very personal stories are set against the backdrop of. I mean, I don't know if I have a question to articulate out of that, but I'm really interested in the balance of those two components.
I don't know. Well, I mean, I would say one thing to think about is like tension, and a story with no tension is really boring and does nothing. So there's got to be something pitted against something else. And yeah.
I think that's it for us. Okay. Thank you guys so much for
Thanks,
coming.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thank you, Atessa.
Aloud is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, the Los Angeles County Arts Commission, the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, Cecilia and Jeffrey Glassman, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and individual Library Foundation members. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.